We'll call our meeting to order this morning, and we'll be continuing on the House File 657. So at this time, we will ask our people from the who is it again? Revenue Department to come forward and take it from there. I think as we remember yesterday, we had gotten partway through the bill and we were going to continue on it today. So if you'd like to start where we left off yesterday, probably we were into what section?
Mr. Chair, I believe this is Lance Sterica with the Department of Revenue, with Ms. Sims explaining Article 2. I think we were at Sections 28.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Committee, Sections 28 and 29 clean up the language for recent changes that we made for the local boards of appeal and equalization governing their training and quorum requirements. Section 30 eliminates some obsolete language regarding the dates that the County Board of Appeal and Review and Equalization meets. Section 31 changes the date by which county auditors have to certify their tax rate to the other county for taxing jurisdictions that cross county borders, delaying that date from September 20th to October 5th. Section 32 eliminates some redundant or conflicting language regarding disparity reduction aid. It's a tax rate adjustment, not a levy adjustment, and the statutes right now tell the auditor to do both. We're getting rid of one of those. Section 33 eliminates a mandate to the commissioner or instruction to the commissioner to include special levy information on particular levy reports, but the special levies are reported under a different statute, so we're eliminating that reference here. Section 34 updates the references to state-paid property tax aids on the property tax statements because of the elimination of HACA, Homestead and Agricultural Credit Aid, and the replacement of that, or more properly, the succeeding aid program, county program aid. Section 33 and 53 and 54 deal with the transmittal of property tax receipts that are due to the state by electronic means. Quite technical changes. We're changing the deadline for the county treasurer to transmit those monies to the state by electronic means from June 29th to June 28th. That way, if that deadline falls on a Saturday, we still get the money before the next fiscal year. On Sections 53 and 54, we're changing the effective date of some provisions that were in the 2003 tax bill. Basically, in 2003, we replaced the instructions to the county treasurers to send checks to the state for this money and told them to send the money to us electronically. But there's about it, because of a mess up on the effective dates, there's about a 2-week window where the treasurers are instructed to both send us the money electronically and write us checks. We're taking care of that in sections 53 and 54. Section 37 deals with moves into the area of tax forfeited property. I think we have a number of 5 or 6 provisions on that. Section 37 deals with what's called prohibited purchasers. There's a number of county officers and employees who cannot purchase tax forfeited land when it's put up for public sale. We were asked a question about that statute a couple years ago and offered our interpretation that it only applies to county officers or employees in the county that's making the sale. The statute is not clear on that currently, and we would like to add that in if you agree. Section 38 has to do with the apportionment of tax sale fund proceeds from the sale of forfeited lands. When the state reenacted its levy in the 2001 tax bill. It became an issue of whether the state was due a share of the proceeds when property forfeits for non-payment of the taxes, because the state will have amounts that were never paid with regard to that property too. Current law contains a fairly complicated requirement where the counties have to keep track of the unpaid taxes by year and then give the state its exact amount from each year, and this could be a number of years, 4, 5, 6 years could be involved, and we're just eliminating the state's share effective with taxes payable in 2004 and thereafter to I believe it's a fairly modest amount of money, and this saves the counties a lot of administrative overhead. Section 39 has to do with the taxability of forfeited lands upon sale. Several years ago now, back in the 90s, we changed the general rule so that tax forfeited property becomes taxable in the current assessment year. Even though it may be sold in August, we say that it should be taxable back to the prior January 2nd. It's kind of, like all the property tax stuff, it's kind of hard to explain simply, but it has to do with symmetry. When the property goes forfeit, it goes forfeit right away, and so we think it's fair that when it goes back taxable, it should go taxable right away. And this provision dealing with some lands in certain areas that were created in 1931-32, it deviates from that general rule, so we're changing that. Sections 40, 41, and 42, strings of statute in this chapter. Each of them says when a sale occurs, Commissioner of Finance shall issue the deed. The next statute, the other statute says when a sale is made, the Commissioner of Natural Resources writes the deed. And we're just clarifying which sale each of those statutes are talking about.
Section 43, by the way, Harriet Sims with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Section 43 would allow the commissioner to require that owners or managing agents submit electronic certificates of rent paid, and that is phased in for various landlords by size. And the first phase then would be landlords with more than 100 rental units in 2006. For those with more than 25 rental units in 2007, and for those with more than 4 rental units in 2008. And the purpose of this is to allow the department to be able to better verify that the information is correct. We're currently checking paper CRPs, certificates of rent paid, against the paper filing that the renters make. Now we've got increased availability of e-filing those filings, and it's difficult to match the electronic against what we're getting on the paper. And this would be, again, effective with certificates issued for rent paid in 2006.
Excuse me, Ms. Sims. Just a question. How much cost savings will the department estimate on this?
Representative, I do not believe we have... I'm not aware that we have estimated any particular cost savings due to this. I can get you that information, though.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Mike Goloffs from the Department of Revenue. This is a little bit different than the other electronic filing recommendations, in that what we're really trying to do is get the data source in so that we can verify electronic filings. So there will be some, as more and more renters file electronically, there will be cost savings associated with the processing of that. But this particular initiative is to just get electronic versions of the CRPs in so that we can start to do electronic data matching. The short answer to your question is we haven't done an analysis of it, but again, the purpose is slightly different.
Okay, thank you. Representative Mullery.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Sims, I don't have a problem with the first couple, but I do have a big problem with going down to four on the 2008. I have a lot of senior citizens that have more than four units, and they don't have computers. They're not computerized. They're retired people that do that, and it seems to me like you're going to be requiring them to pay somebody to go out to do this on a computer. I just don't think that we need to do that.
Representative Mullery, are you referring to the renters who live in the units or to their landlords?
To the landlords.
To the landlords.
I thought that this applied to the landlords.
Yes. Yeah.
That's what I'm referring to. Renters wouldn't own four or five apartments.
That does phase in later on, and we are hoping or assuming that by that time there will be more electronic filing, and that those landlords will be up to filing electronically. The statute, as you know, does not have any particular sanctions for not filing electronically should the commissioner require or ask that these be filed electronically.
Well, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
By the way, members, don't tell the speaker, okay?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sims, I don't think that that's an excuse. People in their 70s that can't figure out computers now are probably not at the age of 80 going to be able to figure them out.
Mr. Madsen, do you have some further information to help Representative Mullery's constituents out? And by the way, I used to work. My dad's business was in Northeast Minneapolis, Representative Mullery, so I know the neighborhoods well, and I know the situations you're talking about very well. Mr. Manson.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Jack Manson with the Department of Revenue, and I just have some numbers that might help you kind of think through this a little bit. As at the threshold of 100 units, that would impact 500 landlords. As you move to the 25 rental units in 07, that would impact 3,000 additional landlords. And then when you move to the four rental units in 08, which is your biggest concern, that would impact an additional 10,000 landlords. But even having said that, as we're at that threshold, there's still 40,000 landlords that would not be required to submit their CRPs electronically. So the key base of this is can still deal in paper if they choose. So the smallest landlords might not really be impacted by this.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Manson, this does affect the people with five units, doesn't it?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mullery, yes, it does. Anyone in 08, anyone that has four units or larger would have to electronically submit the CRP.
Okay, go on.
Mr. Chair, committee, moving on to Section 44. Section 44 deals with the Senior Citizens Property Tax Deferral Program. And
excuse me, I guess Representative Mullery has another question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just found out some more information,
mm-hmm.
Which I wasn't clear on. I believe, is it true also that this could affect a landlord who had one unit but had five different tenants during the year that had CRPs? Is that correct?
Would anybody like to respond to that?
Representative Mullery, reading over the bill, I believe that would be true because the language is based on number of certificates that they are required to issue.
So, Mr. Chairman, now we're down to a person who owns a duplex, maybe in their 90s, has never even seen a computer, and they're having to comply with this. Mr. Chairman, I think at least somebody may have an amendment to this.
Okay, any other comments? All right, we'll continue on. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee, I'm moving on to Section 44. Section 44 has to do with the Senior Citizens Property Tax Deferral Program, and it allows participating senior citizens to defer a payment of any amount that appears on the property tax statement for the property. This would be effective for amounts deferred in 2006 and thereafter. Section 45 makes an update to a statute dealing with the program where the state can guarantee county building debt. If a county were to participate in that program, I do not believe any counties are participating currently, but if they were, statute currently says to offset their HACA payments, Homestead and Agriculture Credit Aid, to make up for the amounts the state has paid on their behalf, and that is being changed to the county program aid. And there are some other outdated references being updated. Section 46 has to do with the Border City Development Zone property tax reimbursements, where a city can decide to use part of its set-aside amount to reimburse someone, the taxing jurisdiction for property tax exemption. And right now the law says they certify this to us in October of the assessment year, and we pay them the next year. And we found that we're able to handle the program if they would certify to October of the taxes payable year, and we can pay them by December 26th. This works better for them, and we can handle it. This would be effective for reimbursements for taxes payable in 2005 and thereafter. Sections 50, 55, and 56 make some changes related to the 2003 Tax Bill, Tax Act. First one eliminates a paragraph in the definition of city aid base for the local, the so-called vote from an aid program for cities. The second one clarifies some language having to do with the uncodified one-time city aid reductions for 2004. And the third, Section 56, clarifies some language with regard to the county aid reductions that occurred in 2004. And each of these changes would be effective for aids payable in 2004 and thereafter. Sections 53 and 54 I referenced before. Section 57 is an uncodified provision that just recognizes that three townships in Lincoln and Pipestone counties adjusted their property tax levy after the deadline for taxes payable in 2004 in order to take into account the wind energy production tax revenues that they were going to get and hadn't previously taken into account. This provides, in case they ever get audited by the state auditor, this provides them with some comfort and protection. Section 58 is the repealer. The first subdivision repeals a number of obsolete statutes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And certainly address any questions if members have a question about a particular statute being repealed. Second subdivision repeals a subdivision in a provision that allows TIF districts to have extended durations if they have deficits. This applies to TIF districts that existed before the 2001 tax reform changes and allows them on an additional four-year duration if they have deficits because of those tax reforms. Subdivision 6 gives them the option for another two-year extension if the Commissioner of Revenue agrees or certifies that. And we are suggesting that Subdivision 6 is not... We're suggesting it's not needed. We certainly wouldn't object if a city came forward and says that it is needed, but we are suggesting that it may not be needed. The last subdivision repeals an alternate tax base for property taxes having to do with the Alexandria Lake Area Sanitary Sewer District and the Central Lakes Region Sanitary Sewer District, which I believe is in the same neck of the woods. And just they have agreed that they would not levy property taxes on these this alternate tax base, and therefore we would like to get rid of it. It should be effective for taxes payable 2006 and thereafter. If there are no more questions, I believe that's the end of Article 2.
Any additional questions on Article 2? If not, then let's move to Article 3.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Greg Heck, and I'm with the department. I'll be going through Article 3, the sales use tax article. Section 1 was in last year's department's proposal. It basically clarifies that the 25% the 25% omission on the use tax return, the statute of limitations extended to 6.5 years. This is similar to the way we currently try sales and withholding taxes currently. Section 2 deals with the situation where a vendor improperly collected tax on a construction project or on a non-taxable service. Under those situations, the vendor should have paid tax under import and should not have collected the sales tax. In a number of cases, the purchaser filed a refund claim with the department near the end of the 3.5 year period of limitations for refunds, and then we have to turn around and assess the purchaser on their inputs. This would allow us to assess the net purchaser within the normal 3.5 year limitations period or within 1 year after the order for refund. This situation comes up a couple times each year. Section 3 deals with the definition of bad debt. Back in 2003, the legislature amended the definition of bad debt under Chapter 289A. Our intent was the changes to only apply to sales tax. The changes were a little broader than that. We're now clarifying that those changes only apply to sales tax. Sections 4 and 5 deal with purchaser refund claims and capital equipment claims, setting the statute of limitations period. This would provide that the refund claim must be filed within 3.5 years after the date of the 20th day of the month following the day of the invoice. There have been a couple tax court cases indicating that the court believes there's some ambiguity as to when the statute began to run, and therefore we want to clarify this in the statute. Section 6.
Excuse me, Mr. Heck, just a moment. On section on the time limitation for refunds, can you say what there have been a couple of court cases? What's the ambiguity?
Well, the ambiguity is when the capital equipment claim has to be filed. There have been some taxpayers that believe that it began to run from the date the retailer filed their tax return. And there's also been questions when the retailer has an extension of limitations for audit purposes, whether that also applies to the purchaser. So what we're trying to provide here is basically a bright line standard. Basically, the purchaser would have 3.5 years from the date they actually made the purchase of capital equipment to file their refund claim. They would not have to depend upon the vendor's filing cycle, because they're not going to know if the vendor's on a monthly, quarterly, or annual filing cycle, nor will they know whether the vendor has an extension of limitations to file the return. Therefore, this is a bright line standard for all purchasers.
What's the bright line on the audit? How far back can you audit them?
3.5 years for purchases for use tax.
Okay. So it's the same. They have 3.5 years to file for the refund?
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Representative Mulry.
Mr. Chairman, that just raised a question. If they get an audit after up to 3.5 years and they have to file, if they're triggered, then they can't file if you audit right at the end. In other words, they don't have a period to file afterwards.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulder, yes, they do. Under Chapter 289A, now, if we issue an audit order, we make an assessment. If they pay the audit assessment, they have 1 year after the date they pay the audit assessment in full to file a refund claim. So anytime we file an audit, they have 1 year after the date of that order. Section 6 deals, is merely a clarification that dietary supplements are a taxable food item. This is the way the department has currently interpreted it and the way the taxpayers have always applied this provision. It's something that came out of Streamline. Section 6 also deals with the lodging tax. We're clarifying that you have to stay 30 days at a specific facility, not a specific room, in order to get the exemption.
Excuse me again here. When you say that this has been the interpretation that dietary supplements are in Streamline, then why? I mean, you're adding language here that says that dietary supplements are not exempt. But in the, it seems from reading the language that they previously were exempt.
Mr. Chairman, no, dietary supplements were always taxable. They weren't treated as a food item previously. That's the change we're really making here, that we treated dietary supplements as a mineral or vitamin that were subject as an item of tangible personal property. Streamline initially took that position. Now they're taking a position they are a food item, but they are a taxable food item. So all we're saying now is it's a taxable food. Before, they were just a taxable other item of tangible personal property. It's merely a matter of semantics. Now they're taxable food. Before, they were taxable tangible personal property.
So can you help me here in terms of you? This is put down as a technical item. Why is it technical versus a policy change?
Mr. Chair, we believe it's technical in that we're not changing the tax base, that they were always subject to tax. All we're doing is calling them food versus non-food. Before, they were taxable non-food. Now they're taxable food.
Okay.
I guess we view that as being pretty tactical.
So, all right.
Section 7 deals with purchases for resale, and all we're providing here is that if a retailer is going to buy something for purchase to be resold, it has to be resold in a normal course of business. And basically, we've already defined in the statute what normal course of business is. It basically demonstrates a commercial continuity in order to make profits or to produce income. Section 8 is purely a technical change. We're basically clarifying that the motor vehicle rental tax and fee do not apply if that rental is not subject to the general sales tax under Chapter 297A. Section 9 deals with sourcing under Streamline. And under Streamline, we weren't required to use the general sourcing rules for certain items, watercraft, aircraft, modular homes, manufactured homes. Minnesota is electing to use the general sourcing rules for those items. Section 10 is we're correcting an oversight. This is on sourcing on transportation equipment. This was language was inadvertently left out of our language in 2003. No change there. Section 11, we're back on the dietary supplements again. This is the exemption for food items, and we're just clarifying here that dietary supplements are, in fact, food items. Section 12 deals with industrial production, and we're clarifying here that anyone who performs taxable services, these are the 1987 taxable services, building cleaning, car washing, dog grooming, whatever, do not get the benefits of industrial production. The legislature back in 2002 did give them a specific exemption under 297A-68 subdivision 3. So they have a comparable exemption. We just don't treat them as industrial production, we treat them as inputs to taxable services. There's no need for this overlap in the statutes. Section 13 deals with capital equipment. We're also clarifying there that the 1987 services don't qualify for capital equipment treatment. This is a provision that was in last year's bill, also clarifying that restaurants don't get capital equipment treatment. This is basically came out of the Leanne Chin's case. We're not attempting to reverse the Leanne Chin's case. We're basically codifying the result there that if you have an off-site production facility that prepares processed food, you do get capital equipment, the actual restaurant unit where they serve meals to the restaurant patrons. They don't get capital equipment in the restaurant unit itself.
I have a question on the next part of Section 13. It says we're correcting the inadvertent 2003 drafting error that repair parts for ready-mix concrete trucks qualify as capital equipment. Purchase, lease, ready-mix concrete trucks are exempt from sales tax. I'm having a little trouble understanding that I believe it's the Great Lakes pipeline case, Mr. Michael, but the we're saying in the proposal that's in the governor's bill is saying that reversing the court case where compressors used in transmission of natural gas do not qualify for capital equipment provisions, but now we're saying that a concrete truck does. Can you help me try to understand where the transmitting natural gas doesn't qualify, but a concrete truck that's got little rubber wheels on it and moves up and down the street does? Can you help me with that one?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This results from a compromise that that the department had and the legislature endorsed back in 1998 when we didn't tax delivery and transportation charges under the sales tax. At that point in time, the ready-mix industry was breaking out part of their charge for delivery charges when they delivered ready-mix concrete. And they agreed as part of the compromise that if they would, if we would treat the ready-mix truck as a manufacturing unit, which certainly is being mixed as on the way to the site, that they would agree to collect and remit sales tax under delivery charges. So this is basically a compromise resulted in 1998. In 1998, the legislature added language to the capital equipment statute which basically said ready-mix trucks qualify as capital equipment. In 2002, the department came to the legislature and decided that really the trucks, because no other motor vehicles get capital equipment treatment, we should separate the trucks from the mixer unit. So we added language to the statute that basically said the mixer unit qualifies for capital equipment, and the legislature then put a separate exemption in Chapter 297D for the truck itself. By doing this, it could be argued that we inadvertently took away their exemption for repair parts that the legislature gave them in 1998. So basically, all we're trying to do is restore the faith with the ready-mix industry, give back to them what the legislature gave them in 1998. I agree with you. There may be some inconsistency the way we're treating the gas line pipeline, but I guess that's a legislative decision to be made. But what we're trying to do is restore the faith with the ready-mix industry, the compromise that was made by the legislature in 1998.
So, Mr. Heck, to help me understand this a little better, are there any other types of delivery or transportation equipment that we give this treatment to?
Mr. Chairman, there are none that I'm aware of, but there would be very few types of equipment that actually are engaged in production manufacturing on the way to the site. Most delivery vehicles would just be delivering. The product would already be in its finished state. The concrete ready-mix truck continues to mix the concrete and until it actually gets to site, and sometimes they actually have to add ingredients at the site before they actually dump it out of the truck. So, I mean, they're about the only type of vehicle that I'm aware of where the production process continues on the way to the site.
How about a compactor on a trash hauling truck?
That would be true if they were selling the compacted garbage, but they are selling the compacted ready, or they are selling the processed ready mix. I don't think they're selling the compacted garbage. In fact, I think they have to pay to get rid of it.
Okay, we'll leave concrete ready mix ready mix trucks in the dust here and move on.
So. Okay, the only other thing I'll mention in Section 13, we're clarifying that. An oversight that happened during the sales tax recodification, we're providing that for online data retrieval, equipment has to be used mainly for that particular service, We've checked this out with the revisor statutes. This was just an oversight that happened during recodification. Section 14, we're clarifying that the only equipment that qualifies for the telecommunications equipment exemption is that equipment as defined under the definition that's contained now in 297A61 and subdivision 24. Section 15 is a change that legislature made back in 2003 where there wasn't a six-month transition period put in when the sales tax base was changed to add new items subject to sales tax. If a contractor entered into a contract, a binding contract or a bid to do a construction project. And what we're basically proposing here is that also if the legislature raises the rate, that six-month transition period would still apply. But this is basically a fallback position. If the legislature decides not to give them a transition period or give them a longer one, they can certainly do this. This is only a fallback if the legislature fails to address that in the effective date. Section 16 basically provides that we're going to use the same sourcing rules for the local sales tax as we use for the state sales tax. Section 17 also deals with local sales taxes, and it basically provides that advertising materials and packing materials that are sent outside the jurisdiction of the local tax jurisdiction will be exempt from the sales tax to the same extent we now exempt advertising materials and packing materials when they're sent outside the state of Minnesota. So we're basically bringing some uniformity between the state and local sales taxes.
You want to, what precipitated this change?
Well, there had been a couple of questions on it, and we're basically just trying to make them uniform since the department basically is obligated to administer and collect all the local sales taxes. And when we go out and do the audit, it makes it much easier for both us and the taxpayers to have the same standards to apply to these types of situations, that if it's sent outside the jurisdiction, it would be exempt in all cases. Obviously, if it's sent outside the state of Minnesota, it's obviously going to be sent outside the jurisdiction of the local tax, but also if it's sent outside the, you know, say it's the business located in Minneapolis, it's sent outside Minneapolis by mail, then we're taking a position it wouldn't be subject to the Minneapolis tax because the item is never used or consumed in Minneapolis. It's the same principle that we've applied for the state tax.
So if I contract for advertising with a firm in Minneapolis, and my business is located in St. Paul, what tax do I pay?
If that firm had a physical presence in St. Paul, they would be required to collect the St. Paul sales tax. In your example, if you had your business in Minneapolis and sent it to Bloomington, that advertising firm wouldn't collect any sales tax on those materials that went outside the city of Minneapolis. So if it went from a taxing jurisdiction to a non-taxing jurisdiction, there wouldn't be any tax. They would have to collect tax on those advertising materials that remained in Minneapolis, but if they left the city of Minneapolis, there'd be no tax on them. The same way now, if you have a Minnesota advertising agency, they print that brochures. If 90% of those brochures go outside the state of Minnesota, they only collect tax on 10%. The 90% that leave Minnesota are non-taxed.
But the but again, let's go back through this. As I said, if I contract with an advertising firm in Minneapolis, my business is located in St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to pay the the additional half cent sales tax in Minneapolis because that firm is located. If the firm's located in Minneapolis, does not have a presence mm-hmm. in St. Paul. Then I don't have to pay the additional half cent Minneapolis local option sales tax, correct?
Mr. Chairman, you would have to pay the St. Paul 0.5% use tax for those items that remained in St. Paul. You would only pay tax on those advertising materials that actually stayed in St. Paul. If the Minneapolis firm sent all those materials to you and they didn't have a nexus, they wouldn't collect any Minneapolis sales tax. They would not be collecting the St. Paul sales tax because they don't have nexus. You would be required to pay use tax on any advertising materials you kept in St. Paul. If you sent them to all your St. Paul customers, you would owe use tax on all those materials. If you sent 50% of those materials outside of the city of St. Paul, you'd pay use tax on 50% of those materials.
You understand this one, Representative Mallory?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think I'm starting to understand, and I'm just wondering who got to who to raise this exemption. Somebody has a good lobbyist, apparently. I don't understand why we are... What is the policy that's demanding this change, this global policy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullins, the main reason behind this is we want to make the state and local taxes consistent. I mean, under the current sales tax chapter, local taxing jurisdictions are mandated to have the same tax base as the state. So our attempt here is to make them identical tax bases. They have the same rules and guidelines for both local and state sales taxes. That's our main reason for proposing this.
Representative Mallory.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not getting how this would... You have the same guidelines, but you're talking about the state guidelines with respect to other states. You're taking that to within the state. I don't know why those two have to... I've never heard a great policy on why that applies.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mallory, the legislature has already done that, has already adopted that policy for anything other than advertising materials or packing materials. If someone goes into Minneapolis and buys a refrigerator, and that Minneapolis firm delivers that refrigerator to Bloomington, or has it shipped out by common carrier to Bloomington, they don't collect the Minneapolis tax. The legislature has already adopted that policy for everything else. They say that if you buy something in Minneapolis and it's sent out by common carrier, by U.S. mails, or the seller delivers out in their own vehicle, there is no local tax on it. So we're just making it consistent with that. This is a policy that the legislature has already adopted for. Because the item, and the theory behind it is the item is not being used or consumed in the taxing jurisdiction. The fact that you bought it there doesn't make it taxable unless you actually get possession, title or possession in the city.
Representative Mueller, I think this makes a good case for why we don't want a lot of additional local option sales taxes. But
well, Mr.
So let's remember this, members, as we move down the path. I don't think we want another 12 jurisdictions with local option sales taxes. But go ahead, Representative Mueller.
Mr. Chairman, so if it's printed in Minneapolis... It's going to be distributed in suburbs, not Minneapolis. Then the printer makes the decision as to which mail house to use based on if they use one that's in Minneapolis, a block within Minneapolis, then they get charged for the tax, but if the mail house is outside, they don't get charged then? It's across the street.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulry, I wish it was that simple. It would not be taxed if they use the mail house outside the city of Minneapolis. But even if they use a mail house in the city of Minneapolis, if the purchaser gives them an exemption certificate certifying where those materials are going to ultimately end up, if 90% of them are ultimately going to end up outside the city of Minneapolis, even the Minneapolis mailing service would only have to collect tax on 10%. The exemption we have for advertising materials is a dual exemption. Not only does it exempt the seller, it exempts the purchaser. If the purchaser is going to ultimately send them outside the city or the state, they can exempt it. It's a dual exemption, not only for the purchaser, it's an exemption for the ultimate destination of the advertising materials, not where they're actually picked up. It's it's a fairly complicated mess.
We'll leave this topic for a while, and we'll
maybe the mess was the wrong word.
We'll move on down the road to article.
I got two more sections, Mr. Chairman. Yes. Section 18 deals with when a local tax terminates. The Department of Revenue generally keeps amount of local tax revenues in reserve to handle contingent refund claims when they come in. This section deals with situations where we don't hold enough tax in reserve and there are refund claims that come up after the fact that exceed the amount we have in reserve. This would allow us then to offset the local government aid of that political jurisdiction to offset the amount the general fund is shorted by those refunds. Section 19 deals with repeal some obsolete sales and use tax rules. We've worked with revisor statutes on these. The vast majority of these rules resulted from the recodification in 2001 and became obsolete as a result of that recodification.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, the rule about using the, if the user is outside of the city, has that changed in the last decade or something? I remember at one time over 30% of the sales tax in the state was collected in Minneapolis. Now, it wasn't all people eating in Minneapolis, so I assume people were buying sweaters, refrigerators, and everything and taking them to someplace else in the state, because we didn't have 30% of the citizens in there. That weren't that many people eating or drinking in Minneapolis. So has that changed or something?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulray, it hasn't. But anything picked up in Minneapolis would be subject to tax, regardless of where it's going to ultimately be used, except for advertised materials. It's the advertising material rule that has the dual exemption, but anything else picked up in Minneapolis is subject to the Minneapolis tax.
We'll work on this one later, Representative Mulray. All right, thank you, Mr. Heck. We appreciate you're trying to walk us through that little thicket of sales and use tax.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Pat Finnegan. I work as an attorney in the Revenue Department. I'll take you through Article 4, the special taxes article. Most of the provisions are carryovers from last year's technical bill. Article 4 deals with a variety of different tax types, and I'll try to identify them as we proceed. Section 1 deals with the mortgage registry tax. It's simply a reference to a mortgage registry tax exemption that's already in another section of the law, and we're referencing it in the mortgage deed tax registry tax exemption section. It has to do with National Guard armory buildings, which would be exempt. Sections 2, 3, and 4 are Minnesota CARE provisions. Section 2 is a new definition of blood components. Section 3 is a definition of gross revenues. It excludes blood and blood components from the legend drugs. And Section 4 has to do with an exemption for our Federal Employees Health Benefit Act. Payments received under that act remain exempt from the tax. This would clarify that enrollee deductibles, coinsurance, and co-payments are subject to the Minnesota CARE tax. Section 5 is a FER tax proposal. This return is filed once a year, but the payments are paid throughout the year. This would allow estimated payments to be made based on the actual gross revenues received during the year. Section 6 and 7 are petroleum tax provisions. Section 6, currently the law provides a petroleum tax exemption for gasoline and diesel fuel that's used in licensed ambulances. This would extend that exemption to aviation fuel. Section 7 is...
Excuse me, Mr. Finnegan, can you give me, again, what... from whence did Section 6 emanate? What's what was the logic or the reason behind the change?
Mr. Chairman, the proposal came from an auditor within the Petroleum Tax Division, just reviewing the laws, trying to make some consistency. They saw that the there was an exemption for gasoline and diesel fuel tax for licensed ambulance services, and they just noted that there wasn't a similar exemption for the aviation fuel, so that was the only reason.
But aviation fuel isn't taxed at the same rate as the fuel for vehicles.
That's true, Mr. Chairman. The aviation fuel is taxed at a lower rate, 5 cents a gallon, and the diesel and gasoline are taxed at 20 cents a gallon.
So they already get a significantly lower tax rate, so I'm not understanding why we should, and there's also a loss of revenue with this provision?
Mr. Chairman, yes, the research division estimated it to cost about $15,000 a year.
Representative Bill?
Mr. Chairman, well, in defense of the aviation tax, the aircraft uses a hell of a lot more fuel than a car on the same, you know, a similar trip.
But that's not my fault.
Yeah, but when you need to get there in a hurry, it's important that you use it. the secondly is so what you're saying is, and I'm asking this, an air taxi operator who would fly an air ambulance flight, that part of the fuel for that flight would be exempt from the 5 cent a gallon tax?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, if they're licensed, if they're providing a licensed ambulance service, that portion of the fuel would be exempt.
Well, there's going to be a lot of emergency flights. I can feel that one coming on already.
Well, I guess the other question that I would have in this area is if you're going to exempt these are licensed air ambulance services, Ms. Fingen. How are we defining who qualifies?
Mr. Chairman, they're licensed by they're licensed by the Emergency Service Regulatory Board in Minnesota. That board licenses ambulance services, so they would license both the over-the-road ambulance services as well as the aviation ambulance services.
But if let's just throw in another caveat, we aren't going to exempt people who are flying, say, a search and rescue type of performing, civil air patrol flying. Search and rescue type situations, we wouldn't exempt them.
Mr. Chairman, not that I'm aware of. I mean, if the legislature chose to do that, it was just to be consistent with the ambulance services that are provided over the road. I mean, it's a policy decision whether you want to extend that exemption or not.
Chairman.
Representative Bill.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are the I've been out of that business for 20 years, so a lot has changed. Are the licensed air carriers that are providing this ambulance service, are they subject to the Minnesota Care Provider Tax?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biden, I don't believe so.
We might have someone expert in the audience.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my name is Michal Garber. I'm with the Department of Revenue. Ambulance services are subject to tax unless they are volunteer ambulance services, and then they are exempt.
Representative?
Well, I don't know anybody that has a Learjet that's volunteering, so I'm just wondering if they're paying the tax.
So more specifically, can you, if you're an air ambulance service, are you paying provider tax?
If you don't qualify as a volunteer ambulance service and you employ health care provider, which I assume they do, you would have to pay the provider tax.
I'm sure that someone within the department can confirm that they are paying tax for us. Can you not?
Mr. Chair, I'll have to get back to you on
that. Oh, I understand that. I understand. Just look through the files and find one of those folks and just you know, confirm for us that indeed they are paying the tax. So, any other questions on Section 6 then?
Yeah.
Sorry, Representative Vanderbeer.
Mr. Chair, I might as well muck this up a little more. I've got a, as long as we're on airplane taxes, does propane pay the gas tax? Propane powered vehicles?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there's not a tax on the, not a gasoline tax on the propane, if that's what your question is.
So, Mr. Chair, all those propane powered vehicles don't pay anything for roads? Is that?
There is a motor vehicle tax, it's just not, it's not the gasoline tax.
So the propane vehicles pay a different tax?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes.
Mr. Chairman, Michael Loss from the Department of Revenue. All of the alternative fuels pay a comparable tax to the motor fuel tax, but the rates are adjusted based on the fuel contents of the fuel. So propane does pay a motor fuel tax at a different rate than gasoline. The same is true with natural gas vehicles and E85 vehicles and stuff.
So is it based like on the energy output or something? Okay, thank you.
All right, said no further questions then on Section 6.
Section 7 is a petroleum tax penalty abatement language. We're adding those provisions to the petroleum tax statute. There already is general authority in Chapter 270, but we're extending the authority for all the penalties under Chapter 296A. The next several series of proposals are lawful gambling tax proposals. They're related to linked bingo provisions. Bingo is a form of lawful gambling, and as a result of the 2003 legislative session, linked bingo game provisions were added to Chapter 349, which is the Lawful Gambling Control Board statute, who regulate lawful gambling in Minnesota. And we're just trying to pick up the same definitions for our tax purposes. They're all technical changes, so we won't change the way we administer the tax at all. So Section 8 is a definition of distributor. We'll be adding linked bingo game providers. Section 9 is a gambling product. We'll be including linked bingo paper sheets. Section 9 is a definition of linked bingo game. Section 11 is a linked bingo game provider. Section 12 is a section dealing with business records. And it defines records for lawful gambling taxes to provide that business records also include copies of the new electronic checks. This is as a result of the Check 21 federal legislation. And then Section 13 is just providing the department inspection rights related to linked bingo game providers. Section 14 is a cigarette tax proposal. The department receives reports of shipments of cigarettes out of state, and this is just clarifying that these reports are only going to be required in relation to cigarettes manufactured by companies that are not original or subsequent participating manufacturers in the master settlement agreement with other states. Section 15 is a bond requirement. The department is seeking authority to require bonds from cigarette distributors in certain situations. Most states have these cigarette bonding requirements. Sections 16 and 17 deal with 16 is a cigarette tax return and 17 is the tobacco products tax return, and they're dealing with the June accelerated returns and payments, which were repealed a couple years ago, and then they were reinstated. The returns are normally due on the 18th day of the month following sale. These are just clarifying that for the returns for the May return and the June return, when those returns will be due. Section 18.
Excuse me, sir.
Yes, sir.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just wanted to jump back to the bond for a minute, if we could. I guess I'm just wondering, how many other products do we require a bond on? And then are you having trouble with noncompliance or having trouble with collection? What's the reason for the bond?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm not sure what other industries we require bonds. I know there was a bonding requirement for sales tax permit holders at one time. If the permits were revoked and then they were trying to get it reinstated, we could require a bond. But I'm not really aware of other ones. We have had some problems with certain cigarette wholesalers who have gone out of business owing the department considerable amounts of tax. And the taxes can accelerate rather quickly. A cigarette wholesaler could have $300,000 or more of tax for 1 month. So what this would allow us to do is when we see a problem, we could step in and require bonding before providing them with any further stamps.
Mr. Vandeveer.
Mr. Fuss, how much do you think that you've lost not having this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm just guessing, but I think it's $300,000-$400,000 of tax that I've heard that we've been able to uncollect because wholesalers have gone out of business owing those. But I could probably get that more detailed information from them.
And then over how long a period, because there's a cost to getting these bonds, too.
I'm aware of, Mr. Chairman, Representative, only of situations within the last year or two. But I'll try to find that information.
If you can get that back to me. Great. Thank you. Go ahead.
Section 18 is a liquor tax proposal. Currently, all the liquor tax returns are filed on a monthly basis. This would adopt a sales tax threshold and allow quarterly and annual payments where liquor wholesalers have small amounts of tax owing, so that they could file monthly if there's a five, or they could if they have $500 or less during a quarter, they could file quarterly. If they have $100 or less a month, we'd allow them to file on an annual basis. Section 19 and 20 are insurance tax provisions. Section 19 is simply a definition of reinsurance. The tax is imposed on gross premiums, and the definition of gross premiums excludes premiums for reinsurance, but we didn't have a definition of reinsurance, so we department worked with the Commerce Department, who regulates the insurance industry, and we came up with a definition for the reinsurance. Section 20 was is deleting obsolete language and restoring some language that was inadvertently omitted in the 2000 session. This proposal came from the revisor's office, and apparently there were changes made in the 2000 insurance tax recodification bill and the 2000 omnibus tax bill, and this just puts those language, restores it into the same section. Section 21 is a repealer of an allocation of payment rule for lawful gambling. We already have an allocation of payment rule in Chapter 270, which would apply to all the taxes, so this this provision is unnecessary. So that completes Article 4, unless there's further questions.
Any other questions on Article 4? If not, we'll move into Article 5. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, Jack Manson again. And this Article 5 deals with mandating electronic payments, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about why we're doing this. And it was very controversial last year in this committee, but it is important for us to bring this issue once again to the committee, we feel. And what it does, when we get electronic payments, it does provide more accurate information, accurate payments, accurate application of those payments. The department obviously has to handle less paper, and we do save about 20 cents per transaction, electronic versus paper. So that is important to the department, is that we try and control our costs. And also we've done surveys that most businesses do prefer that they interact with us electronically. Now, back in July of 2001, we did mandate electronic filing on sales tax and for withholding Mincare and sales tax. And at that point, too, it was somewhat controversial, and we heard some arguments that, you know, the smaller taxpayers wouldn't be able to comply. But since then, the comments we hear now are generally compliments. They're very happy with the system. And we are getting, of course, about 85% of those filed electronically via the web, and 15% of those via touch-tone phones. So always when we do these changes, there's always some controversy. The 20,000 threshold that we're targeting in the first phase is the same as we have in the law now for corporate income taxpayers. And there are various thresholds for withholding is the same as federal. Sales tax is currently at $120,000 of liability. So this is a big jump. We realize that. But if you look at kind of how these taxpayers are made up of, these aren't really the smallest taxpayers that we deal with. Generally, if you look at withholding, if you go to a $20,000 threshold, that's really, those are our monthly filers, which are our more frequent filers. So it's not our quarterly or even annual filers. So it is the larger companies. And maybe more importantly, is there's no cost to the business. We do allow them to file through our e-file Minnesota, where we pay the transaction, or also they can file free by phone too. So generally, there is no cost to the taxpayer. I think we get about 85% of our transactions that way. So, and then also, we would also notify any of these taxpayers if this law does pass that now they are required to pay electronically. I'm sorry. So, but maybe I'll ask Rick Walzer, the attorney from our legal division, to kind of walk through the sections and describe them. But and we can go back to questions here.
And thank you. My name is Richard Walzer. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. Article 5 deals exclusively with amendments to the electronic payment provisions. We're not talking about filing. We're just talking about payment. The article primarily enacts a new statute in Chapter 270 so that it will apply to all tax types, establishing a uniform threshold of $10,000 or more per year in which business taxpayers will be required to pay electronically. This is phased in over a two-year period so that in 2006 the threshold will be $20,000. And then that will be lowered to $10,000 in 2007. This will not apply to individual income tax and the three other tax types that are mentioned in the summary. There will be some new taxes that will be brought in that currently don't pay electronically. Those are the occupation tax and gambling taxes from charitable organizations. All the existing dollar thresholds are being repealed, and there are certain groups of taxpayers that are now required to pay electronically regardless of dollar amount, and those people are not impacted by this article.
Question, Representative Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, when you talk, what's an occupation tax?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a mining tax.
Okay, and then back to the charitable gambling, does that include like pull tabs, the Lions, the Rotary, Legions, VFWs, across the whole state?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. Distributors who manufacture pull tabs already are required to pay electronically, so this will only bring in the charitable organizations that conduct the gaming themselves.
Mr. Chair, have you discussed this with, are they aware of this at all, or had any conversations with them about this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there hasn't been a lot of public discussion on the bill until now because it's only been recently made public. Traditionally, the reports that the department receives from manufacturers and distributors have been filed electronically, and this would just move the organizations into electronic filing. Some of them already do it, but they haven't been mandated to do that in the past.
Mr. Chair, a lot of those people are volunteers and things like that and might not know how to do it, isn't that? This is my concern, but we'll wait and see what their reaction is. Thank you.
Mr. Munson.
Mr. Chair, if I could just clarify, as far as the proposals that are in our bill, we did send out a description of each one of these articles prior to Thanksgiving. It went to the CPA Society, the board of, State Board of Lawyers, went to the Business Partnership and the Chamber and some other organizations, I believe. So some of these ideas, or most of these ideas, have been out there for comment. But I am not sure, in honesty, whether in that description it did talk about the charitable organizations being brought in or not. So I'm not sure. I could check that, but I don't have that document with me.
Chairman.
But most of these proposals have been out in public for prior to Thanksgiving.
I think it would be good if we could get a follow-up on that to make sure that they have been notified. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Manson, I also would be interested in following up on that. Also, I'm trying to get a sense of how many charitable gaming organizations actually file e-file right now versus how many paper file. And then I have, I guess, another concern or question in regards to why the mandate as opposed to if you really want to encourage e-filing versus paper filing, charging a fee for those who choose to paper file versus mandating it either way.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, we actually have tried both approaches. We did, I think it was last year, we've been phasing in a mandated e-filing for individuals, and in that approach, if you wanted to continue to file paper, if you were a preparer and you filed over, and now it's at 100 returns per year, and in order to allow someone to file by paper, they had to pay a $5 fee. So we have used that approach, and that has been successful as well. I think 62% of our returns are now filed electronically. But this approach did work much better. We're obviously at 100% for sales tax withholding and Minnesota Care. So that's on the filing side. But so you raise a good question. We have used both approaches.
Okay, Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr.
Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I think that you should put on your list of people on this Allied Charities because they represent, by and large, I think, the majority of the charitable gambling folks, especially the volunteer types that Representative Vandeveer was referring to. And being involved in organizations that have charitable gambling, it would be for those organizations, it would be a little bit of a leap because they file all of their schedules and all of their tax returns. The ones that I'm familiar with intimately are filed by paper to your department.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative David, we are just talking about payments in this instance, not the filing. But.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Commissioner. Continue on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next and last article on our bill is Article 6, Miscellaneous, and I'll be discussing sections 1 through 14. Section 1 is a carryover from last year's bill. It transfers the duties of the case reviewer for the collection of non-tax debts to the Office of the Taxpayer Rights Advocate and authorizes the advocate to issue debtor assistance orders. Section 2 has to do with delegations of authority of the Commissioner of Revenue, and this amendment says that the delegations from one commissioner would carry over to a successor commissioner until those delegations are revoked. Section 3 is technical in nature. It clarifies that in the case of a consent agreement signed by a taxpayer, which is essentially where a taxpayer consents to an audit, that the date of assessment is the notice date shown on that agreement. Section 4 has to do with offers and compromise. It creates a new requirement that when a taxpayer submits an offer and compromise, they have to include a non-refundable $250 fee. That money is applied to the debt, so it's not. It does go towards reducing the tax debt, even if the offer is ultimately rejected, and the fee can be waived in the case of financial hardship. Section 5 authorizes tax liens to be transcribed from the county recorder's office to the office of Secretary of State. This has to do with the fact that in order for a lien to attach to personal property, it has to be filed with the Secretary of State's office. The next two sections 6 and 7, are both data practices provisions. Section 6 makes the business tax identification number of a business public data, and this would only apply to the state tax ID number. It does not have any impact on Social Security numbers.
Yeah. Excuse me, Representative Vanderveer.
I do have a question on that. Why? What's the reason for doing that?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative, could you repeat the question?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, why would you make the state tax ID number public?
Mr. Chair, Representative, during tax filing season, we get numerous calls for the various business tax types from preparers and even people within the company themselves. They've lost their ID number for whatever reason. So we would just be able to, we would like to be able to give out the number by making it public to facilitate tax administration. We did solicit any comments from business organizations to see if anybody objected to this, and we didn't get any feedback, so we're assuming that that the business community has no objection to making these numbers public.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vandeveer, kind of the instance that we get about 500 calls like this a year, we're estimating, and it's a preparer who's there ready to e-file the return. They have the federal identification number, the name, the address, and at that time they can't get hold of their client. And we can't disclose to them what that ID number is, even though that same ID number is public information for sales tax. Well, since they're filing an income tax return, we're really not allowed to give them that information. So that's, you know, that's why we're trying to do this. We think it's taxpayer-friendly, but I'm sure it can be sensitive in some areas.
Mr. Chair, I can see giving it to the taxpayer, but I'm just, it seems to me when I go to the your website and punch in my number that I can, all my, I have access to all my filing information on the withholding. But,
Representative Nelson, follow up.
Mr. Manson, could you not put some checks in place for some type of identification? The tax preparer must have an identification number or something to that effect, but I think Representative Vandeveer brought up some very valid concerns about this type of confidentiality. I mean, if one of us were to call the telephone company, not just anybody can access just to discuss a telephone account. And this certainly is a lot more sensitive information than something like that. I mean, there's often cases where a person's spouse cannot access information if they don't have the proper IDs. And I think there needs to be more thought given to this for some type of a check in that.
Commissioner, comments?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nelson, we do realize the sensitivity of this. And currently, then before we'd give that information out, we'd have to get a power of attorney. That's what we do now to protect the ID number. So what we were hoping for is to somehow simplify the process and still protect their privacy. And we would willing to explore other ideas out there. This is just one we've brought forward. So.
Representative Mullery, to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To this issue, you say the sales tax number, is that different from this number then for the business?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mulway, it's the same ID number. It's just that we only give that number if it's related to a sales tax activity, if it's a sales tax filing, or if another individual who might be a different individual in that department or a preparer that doesn't file for sales tax purposes, just income tax, they really don't have a need to be given that information. So we're very protective and do not give them that number, even though it's the same. So what we're saying is if they're calling in for an income tax need to know, that we would provide that to them, make that public. But currently we won't do that. So,
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, so somebody could call in and find out they can't get the, for income tax purposes, they can just call in and get it. Say they have a sales tax issue and they can get it that way? Is that correct? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, if a business pays sales tax and withholding tax and corporate franchise tax, they're going to have the same ID number for all those different tax types. But the way the law is set up is that the sales tax permit number of a retailer is public information, but it's the exact same number as it is for the other business tax types. So that's why we would like to see this the number become public so that it's consistent across tax types. And I would like to point out that sometimes all the different ID numbers that businesses get from various government entities, it's for example, if you're a national corporation, you might have a a tax ID number from every state that you do business in. And if even in Minnesota, you might get a tax ID number for unemployment compensation, and you might have another ID number for workers' comp, and businesses lose track of these numbers, and we feel that, you know, we've weighed the security risks as opposed to the benefits that we believe would be furthered for tax administration purposes, and that's why we'd like to see the number made public.
Mr. Walzer, how many other states are making these public currently?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know, but we can certainly try and get that information.
I think it might be kind of information that the committee would like to know, so thank you. If you'd like to continue, Mr. Walzer, please.
Thank you. The next section is an amendment to the definition of who is a data subject for purposes of a business entity. This amendment both clarifies and expands the existing definition. What's in the current law is carried over. So the actual changes are the fact that certain business entities that are not included in the current law are being added, namely limited liability companies, joint ventures, and sole proprietorships. And the other change is that we are adding to this definition individuals within the business entity who are responsible for handling tax matters, such as tax managers and bookkeepers. The reason we're doing this is because those are the people that we actually deal with on practically every tax matter that we come in contact with. So that's why we're making this change.
One moment, Mr. Walzer.
Mr. Chairman and Walzer, the question here would be, as I read this language, you're talking, saying that we're amending this from what is either bona fide shareholders to corporate resolutions to corporate officer to down to people who are employee who is responsible for handling the tax matters, such as a tax manager, a bookkeeper, or managing edit or managing agent. And this is so as a business owner, I'd have some degree of concern that you're going to be talking to someone in my organization who is compiling information to provide versus somebody that has my specific authority to deal with the department on the issue. There's a vast difference between someone who's compiling information from my perspective versus someone who I am authorizing to deal with the department. That employee might be a little disgruntled that they didn't get a pay raise last year, or that they didn't their bonus check wasn't as large as they thought it should have been, and so all of a sudden that this person in statute saying that without corporate authority, resolution, sign off by the owner or the so it seems to me that this is a little broad in terms of where you're going with this.
Mr. Walzer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do have procedures in place that were written by our Chief Disclosure Officer and approved by the Commissioner of Revenue a few years ago to make sure that if somebody says that they are the tax manager of the company, or that they are the bookkeeper of the company, that we are dealing with the person who says that they have this kind of authority. Furthermore, there's another law in Chapter 270B, which says that the Department of Revenue is authorized to disclose tax return information to the extent necessary to administer tax laws. And we want to deal with the individual who has the most knowledge about what the tax information within that company is. I mean, these are the people that we deal with on a daily basis. And I would also point out that the law as it's written now, without being amended, is pretty much a carbon copy of the IRS Internal Revenue Code section dealing with disclosure. And these amendments that we're making here are pretty much what the IRS regs say on how they interpret a very similar code section. So I can understand your concerns about security, but we believe that this is a reasonable amendment.
Well, there's as we like to point out at times, there's a new sheriff in town here in the context that I actually own and operate a business, and my concern is for the people in the state of Minnesota who pay the taxes, not necessarily what's most convenient for the department. So, as I said, I'd like to know that those business owners and operators around the state, that they're the ones who are in control, and they're the ones who have are giving authority for what information and might be convenient for you to talk to the bookkeeper in my company, but it may not be what I want. And so the situation, I think, that first and foremost here is to, in my view of the situation, is to make sure that the people who are paying the taxes are protected, not necessarily making it the most convenient for the department. But anyway, we'll members, I think it's almost 12 o'clock, so we'll continue this discussion next week, if we could. Couple items of business, first and foremost, Representative Knobloch, would you move the minutes of the February 8th meeting?
So moved.
Any additions, corrections, deletions? If not, all those in favor of the minutes as written, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who are opposed, minutes are adopted. Members, I am going to refer 39 bills that are in the committee to the Division on Property Taxes and Local Government Tax to Representative Vanderveer's division. I have copies of those bills here for anyone who wants them, or you can contact Mr. Stone later if you need to know which bills those are. They will also be in the minutes of the next meeting. And for authors, if you've already submitted a hearing request, you don't need to submit a new hearing request. The hearing request will travel with the bill. With that, members, then tomorrow the division is meeting. Representative Vanderveer, your agenda tomorrow?
I believe we're going to talk about limited market value and market value credit.
Should be an exciting time. Don't miss that one. With that, members, meeting adjourned.